Bacon Ideology. I am your co-host, Ian, and as always, I'm here with...
Ryan Swin, hello.
And this week we're looking at episodes 3 and 4 of season 2.
10 a.m. to 12 p.m.
I forgot to write that down. I'm so bad at this. We're looking at really like what I think of as the actual start to the season. I do want to point out right off the bat, mm-hmm. Because I think we only briefly talked about Kassar last sure. time, and that's partially because we'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about Kassar. But I do want to give a shout out for these episodes to James Whitmore Jr., the director, who is like an insane TV pro, has directed, like, I think he's directed like 46 episodes of NCIS or something. Like, this is a man who is working. I was really disappointed to see that he did not, at first I thought he had not directed any episodes of Star Trek, but then I found the delightful bit, which is that in the midst of his 6 episodes that he directed for this season of 24, he also directed 2 episodes of Enterprise. Like, in the same, you know, year span that these shows were running concurrently at the time.
Oh, he directed a Ferengi episode.
Yeah. So we might have to check that out at some point.
Well, 1 from season 1 and 1 from season 2. Mm-hmm. All of his episodes for 24 are in this season, but apparently he began as an actor, which is always fun. It's always fun to see those people who begin as actors and become just massive TV directors.
Yeah. Yeah, he has kind of a Frakes arc.
Does Frakes do a ton of non-Star Trek directing?
He's done some, yeah. I wish he did more, but you know, I think he's kind of happy embedded in that mm-hmm. world. He has directed a few other things, if I remember right.
Going back to like what you were saying about this being sort of the beginning, like sort of the beginning to the season, like it is really interesting. Sort of like, I do think that the choices that they make are quite bold, and like how much they like just clearly just really want to shake things up immediately, just with this whole CTU bombing thing, and especially with when you were last season talking about sort of about Mason, and you were and like I like the way that you're talking about it, I was pretty sure, like in my mind I was pretty sure that you had forgotten that he would not be very long
had
for 24.
Completely forgotten that he dies of Havana syndrome in season 2, which is very real. They're telling us that Havana syndrome is not real now. It's very real. It happens. It happens when you do things like suddenly abandon your coworkers to their fate in a nuclear explosion, or like torture a guy. It's definitely not because you are feeling the psychological strain of, you know, being an evil person. It's 100% because the Cubans have ray guns that they shoot at you, as happens to George Mason in these episodes. Yeah, I it was not until this episode when all of a sudden I was like, damn it. I had totally forgotten. Yeah, and I immediately reflected on last season, and I was like, yeah, I was not thinking of this at all. Yeah, so my memory is much worse for this show than I thought it was. Although, again, it's been a very long time since I've watched it. Like, mm-hmm. it's easily been 15 years.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, I mean, my mind is sort of built for these sort of things, but, like, also just, like, because I've been actually looking forward on the wiki and things like that.
I'm kind of mad about it, though.
It is. Like, it's sort of...
I'm kind of mad at the show for doing that to me right now.
Yeah. Like, it's the thing where it's... I mean, it's... A, it's doubly cruel since he became a main cast member for this season.
Yeah, and he doesn't even make it through the whole season.
No, definitely not.
As I was remembering, I feel like he goes out like a champ, though.
Yeah, he definitely does.
Which is good.
Which is definitely good. Like, it's sort of like Xander Berkeley is just killing it. I mean, he was killing it before, but like that last moment in episode 3.
Oh yeah.
Like the way he plays him getting the news very, very, very properly delivered, as like he'll last maybe a week, maybe a day.
Yeah.
And the like his response to it, like his at least his verbal response to it, is just like a He doesn't even say like anything like that. Like you just see it all in his eyes. Like he is just like really bummed, but like also it's not like quite like he's definitely not accepting, but it's like it's just like this sort of like resignation thing.
Yeah,
that is so good.
And his response to like continue being an asshole is such a great choice. Like, okay, like, you know, I think this is a beautiful example of what can be achieved, you know, when the synergy of like the writers and the actor, like when they're on the same wavelength, which is that his behavior here, having been given a death sentence, is like tells us so much about like how this man has been living before, which is like he's probably like kind of a hard luck guy in his personal life, you know, like things have probably not been going great, and the way he responds to that is just by being a huge jag to everybody. And like here you get like this beautiful example of that, and of course, you know, everybody's complaining about him even more, and all, you know, there's like an irony going on there that, you know, people don't know. But he's absolutely the kind of guy that's like, if I'm going to go back in, like, I'm going to act the way I act, and no one is going to give me pity. Like, this man does not want anybody's pity.
Just put on the suit again. Yeah, like, it's like so he's wearing that, like, that, like, sort of, like, very dowdy sort of robe for half the ensuing episode. And he just shows up without any warning back in the suit. I don't think that there's ever been anything better than in 24 than this specific storyline than just the Mason storyline for at least for right now. Who knows, who might, you know, might not work later on, but like right now I think this is some of the strongest material that 24 has ever worked with. A lot of it is in Xander Berkeley's performance. A lot of it is them like knowing that they can get away with like lines like when he's asked to take off all the clothes and he says, you're not even going to buy me dinner first. Like, that's exactly what he would say. Like, that sort of sardonic thing.
His delivery when he's, is so good.
When he's told, like, that, like, one of the symptoms will be, like, hair loss, and he says, like, I'm used to that.
Yeah. He's, like, playing it off. Yeah, I'm disappointed that our time with Xander is slowly winding down, quickly winding down, rather. From what like jogged my memory, I'm like, oh yeah, this is definitely one of the stronger, you know, subplot character arcs in the show that I can recall anyways. And it does, I think we talked about this in season one, but it does, I think highlight the fact that, the show doesn't really become what people think of as 24 yet, you know, like there's elements here and there, but characters that feel so foundational to the identity of the show, like Mason, are like not gonna make it out of the second season, you know. Like Chloe is not here yet. You know, and it's interesting the way that the show is like trying to position itself, especially in these early episodes, because, you know, when you go out last season like they did, it's like, how do you ratchet that up, like and I think they're like, so far the main stuff is really firing on all cylinders in these two episodes, like one of the best two episode stretches in the show so far. I think
that's probably true. Like it's certainly helped a lot by like a slight reduction, not nearly enough a reduction for me, but a slight reduction in the two extraneous subplots. But like you got Jack just you got Jack slicing his head open and then like trying to break through a safe room with a pickaxe
and that like digital
and a shotgun.
That like digital camera footage of him is some of my favorite stuff in the show. Incredible. Trying to like get to fucking Wald? Uncle Rico hiding behind in his bunker. He thought Patriots were in control, but he was wrong.
I mean, that line, I think that like they don't really talk about the ideology before Jack says like we're Patriots.
Yes, yeah,
which,
yeah,
yeah.
I was like,
which
wait,
me also
what is going
the,
on here?
Yeah, that also reminded me, like, I think this is actually a better example of like the line in Us, when Lupita Nyong'o says, like, we're Americans or something like that. Mm. It reminded me a little bit of that, but, like, there's something very funny about Jack saying that. And, like, also, like, of course, like, that, like, it's a great, that scene is, that, like, sort of long extended stretch with him confronting Wald. It's, like, a great example of the weird, of the sort of, like, have your cake and eat it too sort of
yes
approach to politics that 24 often adopts, and we can get into that later also.
Yeah, because originally these guys are kind of set up just as like they just seem like criminals, right? Like yeah. Maybe they do bank robberies, maybe they do drugs. Mm-hmm. Like it seems at first, because I think I maybe even questioned the last time we recorded, like, why the hell was Jack undercover with these guys? But it's because mm-hmm. they were, like, domestic right-wing terrorists. Right. Like, that becomes sort of clear. And I do, like, it's weird, and I know I'm reading it through, you know, the contemporary moment, but I think that Joe is kind of positioned as, like, this proto-Q or, like, sovereign citizen yeah, militia absolutely. Type, you know, which is yeah. really interesting in a show like in 2002, you know.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I think it's like echoes of Oklahoma City for sure. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Kind of how we saw like that, the kind of like post-Soviet mm-hmm. villains in season mm-hmm. one. Like even though this is now like I think firmly a, you know, post 9/11 show,
mm-hmm.
it's still, those currents are still present in that era.
Right.
And obviously like they're more accentuated in our own.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting how the show is like weaving those things in, and like you said, at the same time, like totally having its cake and eating it too on this front. You know?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I had sort of forgotten like how clearly, ultimately, it sort of articulates exactly what they're trying to go for.
Yeah.
You know, like they say, like giving the like power back to the people, that sort of thing. Like, and of course, these are not necessarily new ideas, but it's still like just like the specific positioning of it here when it's also dealing with this sort of anti-Afghanistan, anti-Middle East sort of rhetoric as well.
Yeah.
Like just like the sort of conglomeration of the two things, and like how it's essentially positioning like the anti-government people used like as being used by it.
Sort of like rubes, yeah.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, and you probably know more about this having looked ahead, but, you know, mm-hmm. I think that this is, like, maybe the first kind of, obviously in the context of the show, we know that there's a kind of greater attack going on, but this is kind of, like, the first layer of the onion, which is, like, oh, these are the bad guys, but not really, because there's bigger bad guys behind them, and then there's even mm-hmm. bigger bad guys behind them, right?
Right, right. I mean, we had that with Ira also. Yes, to a certain degree, but they're, like, you know, explicitly, like, sort of apolitical mercenaries in that.
Yeah.
And, like, and so you have a specific, and like not to of course say too much, but like there's definitely instances of that recurring not only in the show but in the season as well.
Yeah, I think yeah, because it's becoming like, to me, that's like a pattern of the show I remember.
Yeah.
Even as I forget right. the specifics of it, it's like yeah, there's always kind of there's like a shadow behind the shadow, you know, every time. Like that becomes a sort of trope I think of the show, is that
yeah.
And part of keeping the energy moving over the show is like, actually, these people you thought were the main antagonists are mm-hmm. pawns.
Yeah, yeah. I think also, I really think that sort of Jack, or they're sort of explicitly positioning Kiefer undercover as sort of, he reminded me a lot of Taxi Driver, like specifically the way that he has his like big puffy jacket, and he has his hands in his pockets all the time, and then, like it sort of looks like one of those posters for Taxi Driver. I don't know if it's meant, and like also especially the sort of messy self-cut hair, like it kind of reminded me of that for whatever reason.
Yeah, yeah, there's something very intriguing about the idea of Jack being undercover with like right-wing terrorists.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if that's covered in one of the novels.
Oh, I feel like it has to be, at least sometimes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of forward momentum, especially in the third episode, which is definitely helped by having, I think there's like two or three scenes max with Kim in the third episode. Like, it's just her like calling Jack and calling CTU, then showing up at CTU right before his bomb.
Yeah, and same with the wedding stuff. There's very little wedding stuff
yeah.
in that episode.
I think the Kim stuff because you have so little of Gary, it works better.
Gary, like I forgot his name is Gary. Jeez.
Gary. Yeah, I was gonna call him Billy Berg also before. I like how like the first scene of the episode is him just like trying to talk, and then he has such a low pain tolerance to getting stitched up or whatever it is that he just keeps getting interrupted. It's also funny just hearing Kimberly Bauer. I don't know. It's set out. Like, are there any times when Jack is referred to as, is Jack actually legal, or is it a nickname? I'm still not exactly sure about that.
Oh shit. I don't know. I just assumed it was Jack.
John Bauer.
John Bauer. Jackson Bauer. Let's find out. Let's see what the wiki says.
Yeah, the wiki doesn't list anything except Jack Bauer, unfortunately.
That's what I'm gonna go for then. You know. But
Johnson Bauer.
Yeah. Like, what's his middle name? That's what I want to know.
I don't think he has.
Oh, maybe. Okay, what if he's like, all right, hear me out here. What if he's like one of those people who goes by their middle name? And what if he's actually Andrew Jackson Bauer? and he goes by Jack instead of Andy. Maybe. Doesn't he have he has a brother, right?
Yeah, maybe best not to look that up.
Yeah, I'm not gonna go any further. But is his dad also a character at some point or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I won't say anything more than that.
Yeah. That's much later on. I'll forget by the time.
That's true. Also, but yeah, like it's. But anyways, going back to like, I think it's very funny. It's very funny to see Kim on the bus, and it's especially after she says like after Tony says where to go to CTU, and she says like, I can take the bus. The way she says it, like, it's just like absolutely contemptuous. LA buses, like, the main problem with them for me at least is like, it's just like the like figuring out where they go is much more difficult than other city buses I've encountered. But like how I say with most other, like I say about the LA public transit in general, it's not as bad. I don't think it's nearly as bad as people say it is. Of course cars are preferable, but still I don't think it's nearly as bad as people say it is.
I think the thing is, in my experience, not having been to LA but having been elsewhere, is that if you're in, you know, I've never lived in like a major city, so I've only lived in cities where public transportation really sucks. But yeah, you know, if you're context is like even Chicago or New York, then yeah, it's gonna seem like pretty dire that a city the size of LA doesn't have a better, like, I just think it's like a matter of proportion. Like, LA probably has like the maybe even a little bit higher per capita average of like public transportation routes and stops and all of that than, you know, any mid-sized American city. But you know, if you're in Fort Wayne, you're not really going to complain that there isn't, you know, better public transport. I mean, you should complain that there isn't better public transport, but it's just like you just assume that that's how it is everywhere. Whereas if you're in LA, you're thinking, well, like, cities of this size across the globe have all managed to, you know, have some even shitty form of public transportation that's like more efficient than it is there. That's the outsider's impression, anyways. But the thing is, in the magic world of 24, everybody can get wherever they need to go in like mere minutes.
That's true. Like, I would not be surprised if Kim had, this was literally the first time Kim had ever taken the LA bus.
Oh, for sure.
I want to quote from the Los Angeles Place Itself script. this might be a bit too long, but
no, go for it. Do it.
Yeah. Okay. Forget the mystical blatherings of Joan Didion and company about the automobile and freeways. They say nobody walks. They mean no rich white people like us walk. They claimed nobody takes the bus until one day we all discovered that Los Angeles has the most crowded buses in the United States. The white men who run the transit authority respond to the news not by improving service but by discouraging ridership. They raise fares. They stop printing maps of the bus system. They refuse to post route maps or schedules at bus stops. They put their money into more glamorous subway and light rail projects, which is, I feel like fairly accurate. Like, the buses have always been crowded when I've been on it.
First, yeah, so. I think...
And I feel like you actually get a good sort of, like, cross-section of people, just, like, regular people who take the bus every day, even on a Saturday. It felt all right, which is a nice touch, I think.
Yeah, I think Mike Davis maybe even touches on this in City of Quartz. That book is like just so full of detail, but I think he even talks about the way the transit system is kind of set up, and it's like, yeah, of course Joan Didion didn't take the fucking bus, you know. Not a fan, yeah, as they say.
Yeah, I look, the sort of nice detail of that scene, it's like it goes a good ways into offsetting the fact that like when Kim finally finds Megan after Megan, like I don't like it, but I get what they're trying to go for in terms of, like, setting up Kim as like a like inhabiting Terry's role to a certain extent, mm-hmm. like the one looking for the kid this time.
Yeah, that is that is a really good point. That maybe one of the reasons why I really hate this plot line is we've seen it. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. But also the when Kim does find Megan, she's like being led by these Latino men into like behind a chain link fence.
Yeah, I don't know what was going on there. It was so quick that I didn't know if we were supposed to like take any meaning from it in the sense that like, I don't know if it was like, hey, just like, cause she says then something, the kid says something like, you know, I went to look for you or something. Yeah.
Just a classic season one Kim sort of thing.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's like, okay, I couldn't, you said you were going to be right back. So I waited exactly 10 seconds and then I left the hiding spot that you had. Yeah. Yeah, pretty dire stuff.
Yeah, yeah, but yeah, like it's sort of like, I don't know, it irrationally sort of, well, not necessarily rationally, like it is this sort of another extension of the like inherently fearful nature of 24's interactions with regular people on the street and like even in slightly less nice places.
Yeah, I mean, the show has a pretty active hatred of anybody who lives anywhere in LA that doesn't photograph nicely, you know.
That's true.
Like, those people are scary. Particularly like the moments in season one where they're just going to random alleys and you're just like immediately accosted, you know. Right.
Yeah. Not very good.
again though, more confirmation of my theory that 24 is really like a liberal show at the end of the day.
Oh,
that,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It has the same politics as like a liberal big city mayor. You know, this is like Lori Lightfoot.
Rest in peace.
Like, RIP to a real one. There will never be another mayor with fits like that. What can you say? You know, gotta hand it to her.
Yeah, she had a really good one yesterday too, I think. Yeah, they should get Lori Lightfoot on the revival 24 somewhere.
Yeah, they should do like a Stacey Abrams thing and make her the president, like they did on Star Trek. Yeah,
I had forgotten that happened. So when Carl reached that point in his tweet, it was like profoundly amusing thing, especially like. That was like 2 years ago or something like that. Pretty recent, at least.
It was definitely at the height of, you know, Stacey Abrams Save Democracy type type fever. But like that being said, you know, not to get on Star Trek again, but Discovery also very early on has, you know, one of the characters graduating from like Musk University or something idiotic that, right? So like again, like these are the kinds of brains that are writing television. And they were also writing 24, so
yeah, though of course like there's or at least to me there's like very little of that actual like it was a lot less referential, I guess, in terms of like deliberately referencing people, like
the really
the major one I can think of is when there was like that concert at Palmer's rally in the very first episode. Other than that, I can't remember who, like it was some, I think it was like a boy band or something like that. I can't exactly remember.
Yeah, who was it? That's gonna drive me nuts. The show 24 is much more careful about setting this in a sort of fantasy political realm, you know.
Right, right.
I mean, even I think we even discussed last season that it took them a long time to even really mention party affiliation, you know, like,
yeah,
it gets in there, but it's not a big deal made of it.
Oh, it's Green Day.
Oh my gosh. I like that you thought it was a boy band, though. Yeah. Green Day kind of is a boy band.
I remembered it was a band, but
yeah.
Oh, wow. I completely did not realize that in Kim's room in the first episode of day one, she had a poster for Warning on her bedroom wall. Probably one of the less prominent ones, but still.
Like, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, there's a little bit of pop culture stuff like that, but political stuff, like, yeah, they stay away from that, you know.
Yeah.
And I think somewhat to the show's benefit in that they can, in its best moments, it can play around with these people as characters rather than as sort of stand-ins for, you know, whatever you think they might be. But it is funny to see them, you know, kind of contort around those things. Like in the previous episodes when they're like, well, you know, it's a Middle Eastern prime minister.
Yeah, they're going to continue to do that for sure.
Yeah, that like, stuff is going to keep
coming on. The props department decided to rebel or something.
Yeah.
I feel like we want to spend a little time on the non-CTU Jack stuff.
Yeah, I mean...
Bomber stuff also. Yeah. But like, it's sort of...
Maybe we can just hit the highlights. Like, I mean, is there anything we want to say about Kim's whole, like, looping around to CTU and then to the hospital? Like, is there anything left there for us to talk about other than just complaining?
Well, I mean, like, I think I inherently like all the times, because there will be more times where Kim shows up to CTU as a place of comfort, and then like it gets attacked or something like that. Like, I don't think I'm saying too much. Where like that is something that'll happen again in the show.
This is not a place that holds any good memories for her.
No, definitely not. Like, it's sort of
take your daughter to work day is always a nightmare.
It's just inherently amusing to me, just that happening, just like her showing up at exactly the wrong moment. Like, she doesn't even get to say hi to Tony.
No, because then Tony in this episode is like trying to figure out where she's at.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. Like, it's I like how he, like, in the midst of everything, like he tells Michelle to go check the security locks. like it shows like he does care about, you know, Jack, and like he clearly feels bad about Jack also, and
yeah,
and about Kim.
Yeah,
but it's also just funny like him diverting resources in that way.
Well, and also, like, what is going on? Like, the phones work, the security, but apparently, like, nothing else works. I'm confused about the IT setup at CTU.
Yeah, yeah. Like, there's a lot of questions on exactly, like, CTU is eminently open to being attacked, which is, you know, par for the course with what we expect from CTU in sort of their, like, competent incompetence sort of thing.
Well, so, you know, probably like a lot of after, well, you know, 9/11 never happens in the show, right?
Oh,
so
that's true.
they don't end up having these security procedures because of 9/11. But even if they even if they had, you know, like CTU is a third rate agency. They are not you know, this isn't even their main office. Their main office is in DC. So,
oh, that's a good point.
You know, this is just a branch office. They're not it feels like the main office because of the way the show is oriented. Yeah. But, you know, in the ecosystem of, you know, the bureaucracy, this is like the DMV, basically. Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's like division and things like that.
Yeah.
So the DMV. Yeah. Like, it's sort of, it's just, I love how, again, we see the weird wall panels CTU has.
I do like that they blew up the set and it gives them an excuse to change it later, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, it's a bold choice to, you know, especially this early on in the season, to just like throw caution to the wind and like they'll figure it out later exactly how to film around this destruction of the set.
Yeah, a fun bit about the destruction though is that Tony's Cubs mug was supposed to be a casualty.
Right.
But something happened. I'm trying to remember from reading the, I think it was the IMDb trivia.
Yeah, it landed in like the
it got caught in a light or a wire or something, because they threw it up to smash it, and it got caught up there, and so they decided that, like, you know, it's indestructible, and it became sort of this totem throughout the rest of the show, which I greatly appreciate.
Right, right. Like, it's a... At 26 appearances, Cubby has appeared in more episodes than several actors in the main cast. which I don't think, I think Mason barely squeaks it out or something like that.
Cubby is a top 5 24 character, no question.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like it's sort of, it's I think we get a good few looks like at it early on in this season as well. Yeah. Like they like make sure to bring it back.
Yeah.
Like early on, like Tony's main character is like a main character proxy, that sort of thing. I'd forgotten that it was this early on that they decided to be destroyed.
It's not even
that they it would be in like just another thing to do it, like they decided it would be destroyed.
Yes.
It says during the filming of the bombing of CTU, it was decided that the mug would be destroyed in the blast. Bernard tossed the mug into the air, but instead of falling and shattering on the ground, it became caught on some wires and survived. Taking this as a sign, he and the production decided to spare the mug.
I love that. It's really good. That's how artists work, man. That's how you know.
Yeah. Briefly touching on the marriage stuff, which is as dire as ever. I do like the touch of like the dad being sort of affable, but also just like he says like he is a very good like or a damn good businessman.
My daughters just... are my two greatest assets.
Yeah. It's a great portrait of that sort of the way that kind of businessman thinks.
Yeah, I love that. I love that it's like, why are you having him checked out? I had him checked out months ago. Like, catch the fuck up. Like, what is this, amateur hour? You think I was just letting this guy waltz in here? I'm just as racist as you. I'm just better at it.
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about it as being racism. It's just like, this guy.
Yeah.
He's
so like, look, what do you think? I'm a businessman. I'm just protecting my assets.
That, it's the scene where he takes her to the house.
Oh my gosh, that was almost okay. I will say that the wedding stuff at least took on an almost surreal quality in these episodes. Like that almost felt like a kind of like Lynchian, like the music ratcheting up just as you're like driving through this totally banal suburb. Like it's so over the top. Or when she like flips out when her sister and the fiance are like trying to get her to meet the fiance's, what is it, cousin, brother, friend, I don't even remember. Like it seems so, it's like in Twin Peaks when they cut to the soap opera on TV, like the soap opera within the soap opera. Like that's what this feels like. This feels like it's not even taking place in the show right now. Like it's like it's as if Kim is watching it on the hospital TV screen. like that's the effect it's giving me in these episodes.
I really wish that was actually
It would be so much better.
Yeah,
you know,
I wish that they gave this guy, I think that this is the only episode he's in, and like even though they mentioned that he like has a crush on her, I hope that like they had brought him back. Also, his name is Sanjit, which if we're, you know, like I'm certainly not an expert on names, but like I feel like that's from the wrong country, or from the wrong like nation of origin, or language of origin. If I'm not mistaken, if we're supposed to take Reza as at least affiliated with Middle Eastern, like I feel like there was a weird. A weird mix-up there or something like that.
Well, you know, I mean, at the basic level, the show like doesn't care.
Of course.
But like on a more like actual real level, I do like the idea that, you know, one of these terrorists is like a Punjabi Muslim or something who's coming to the U.S. You know, you know, that you're supposed to be afraid of, who's going to blow things up. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, again, I have no idea where this marriage plot ends up going, so I'm just speaking out of my ass here, but yeah, I mean, I can't imagine, like, I don't know how much the show is going to actually pull the rug out from under You Should Be Afraid of Middle Eastern and Other Brown People, if it's going to do like a, or if it's going to like use that as a red herring, or I don't remember how all that shakes out. But of course the show is sort of like indifferent in some sense to this stuff because it's like, it's like to do like a kind of symptomatic reading of it. You know, the show is kind of reflecting, it's playing on and reflecting these cultural fears in the post 9/11 moment. And it has no problem with doing that in a way that is lurid and what's the word I'm looking for?
In poor taste or something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't care that that in playing these up, it's playing into them, right? Not something that matters here, because you can kind of like, the show can kind of have these blinders on. Again, because it takes place in the fantasy world, it thinks it can put up all these guardrails on what it's doing. Hence, like, you know, obviously Kiefer Sutherland, I've no question, is disgusted by, you know, the citing of the show for like a justification of torture. But it's also like, I don't know, man, like maybe that's something, maybe like that kind of thing is, and the way the show portrayed it was something to think about when you were doing it. Not, you know, I mean, it is what it is. I'm making a podcast about the show, so
yes,
I'm implicated in this, but I always felt like, you know, on the one hand, of course it's abominable. Also, like, yeah, what did you think you were doing when you were making this show where a guy tortures people and saves the world? Like, what did you think people were going to take away from that?
Yeah, it's and of course this will be well that the show returns to many, many times. So like, it's definitely something, like, of course this season is a major escalation in that, but like it definitely continues to go on, and we'll continue to see it go on as it continues.
Yeah,
it's still like, other than that, like, this plot is really a non-starter.
Oh my gosh. And like, no idea. I think it's so cagey about the stakes of what's going on here too. Like, again, I really don't remember how all this shakes out.
Right.
So essentially, coming from the perspective of someone who's watching it for all intents and purposes for the first time, I have no idea why this stuff is supposed to be important or how it relates to what else is going on. Like, there's nothing here for me to latch on to.
Right. Like, they've, you know, like they have mentioned the terrorist is supposed to be affiliated with a Sayed Ali, but like there's I don't think they've had any, like, I don't think even CTU has mentioned him at all. Of course, because like they only have Walt as their lead, which also made it slightly amusing to me, or bleakly amusing to me, that they make such a big deal about getting the file, the data off of the NSA, when, like, how much data do they have? Like, I feel like they have almost nothing. Like, it's just Walt and that's it, basically.
I think we're supposed to imagine, you know, all the office drones at CTU, you know, creating dossiers and files. Like none of the characters in this show are actually doing the real work that keeps CTU running. They're all, like, middle and upper management. And then Jack Bauer is kind of like a separate thing altogether, but everybody else is kind of like, they're not sitting at a desk and doing the work, you know, except for maybe poor Paula apparently has done some real work. But, you know, like, here's the thing. If you're going to have the secret but super important files, like, you got to have more than one person that knows the password, you know?
Yeah, that too.
That just seems like a real breach.
One of the things I wrote down in my notes, like, when they're talking about how Paula is the only one who could encrypt it and like break the encryption, it's like, where is Milo? Where is, like, can't they bring
I like to think that, like, the reason he doesn't come back until what, like, season 7 or something crazy, like
season
that.
6
I like to think that he was just, like, so sick of his mistreatment that he went on a real journey. Maybe he, like, moved upstate and, like, started a weed farm for a while or something. Like, you know, maybe he just had, like, a whole other life in between. And then when things, you know, when he needed some money again, he said, well, you know, I guess I can always go back to LA and get that CTU gig again.
Apparently he was transferred to CTU Denver, which is an interesting.
Oh, brutal. Can you imagine? You know, that's probably like, that's got to be one of the worst CTU postings, right?
Like, it's big enough where you still have to deal with, like, you probably have to be on the airport beat a ton.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you're doing all the art, you're like making sure they can do all the arcane rituals at the Denver airport, but you don't get to take part. Like, you don't get to do the fun stuff. You know, you never have any time to hit the slopes or go hiking because you're just constantly buried in paperwork.
Right.
You know, the Miami office is probably just like really always sending you bullshit that you have to deal with. I wonder, do we have like a map of all the different CTU offices? Like, I think
that's a good question.
You know, there's DC. I know there's Miami because I think Mason worked there. And then I think there's one in Arizona that Mason also works at.
Oh, I can. Wow, this is it's not a map. I can read.
Oh, sick.
Out. Okay. In alphabetical order, so like there's gonna be some good ones immediately. Oh. Alaska.
Just Alaska? Alaska. Just Alaska. Do you think it's like? I wonder if it's like an Anchorage or if it's like a polar kind of.
It doesn't say. It just says Alaska. Alaska, Austin, Boston, Chicago, Denver, Detroit, El Paso. I can't tell if this is like the same one or if it's different, but there's a Fairbanks unit.
Oh, okay. So maybe those are the same. Yeah, maybe that's a double.
Maybe. Entry. Apparently, Jack did some undercover work in Alaska. So it's
damn.
Las Vegas, L.A., Miami, New Orleans, New York, Phoenix, San Diego, San Francisco, Seattle, Tacoma, which is where, before transferring to L.A., Mason served as district director. this is from Collateral Damage. When Mason visited the L.A. office to assign Jack Bauer to oversee the opening of the original CTU New York, Mason bemoaned Tacoma's relative isolation and unimportance in the chain of command, apparently blaming Bauer for his getting assigned there. And then Virginia and Washington.
Okay, so 24 Revival, it opens with a bearded and haggard Jack Bauer trekking through the Alaskan wilderness.
I hope he plays himself like in like one of the wilderness periods between like, I don't know, maybe season 3 and 4. Like he decides to transfer there.
Yeah, he's like, no, he's like out of favor with the bureaucracy, right? CTU has gone woke and they have banished Jack Bauer to Alaska, where he's embedded, again, back on his old beat of being embedded with right-wing terrorists who are actually working for the Russians, right? Obviously. And so, you know, the whole mini arc of the beginning of the episode, of the beginning of the season could be him, you know, unraveling this and finally getting his flowers again. Maybe a certain TV personality has been elected president and says something like, you know, Jack Bauer, you know, he's done very good work. He's been recognized more and more and then elevates him to like a cabinet position. And then at the State of the Union, you know, they all draw straws or whatever. And Jack Bauer is the designated survivor. And in episode 4, a nuclear bomb goes off at the State of the Union, and Jack Bauer is now president of the United States. That's the first 4 episodes of the 24 Revival that I will be writing for, for Fox.
We need to get Sarah Palin playing herself.
Oh, somewhere. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they could go like snowmobiling or something. Do like kind of a Bond, like a Bond skiing sequence with Sarah Palin in Alaska.
Were there some like, wasn't she just like palling around on Instagram with some people or something like that? Like, she's clearly got the time.
She's got nothing going on. Yeah, nothing's going on there.
No, no. Okay, back to it.
Okay, I do think though, all right. I do think though that it is sort of funny that this show never went like the NCIS CSI route and tried to do like CTU Vegas or CTU.
Oh Denver. Yeah.
Like, I mean, I know, different seasons end up in different locales, but it's interesting to me that like the show is so focused on Jack Bauer. Like I couldn't imagine a version of the show that, like, I think that's sort of why Legacy didn't catch on. You know, I think at that point it was like too late to be like, we need another person, you know?
Right. 6 whole seasons just in LA. And with Jack. Yeah, Jack, of course, is the anchoring even when they moved to other places. But still, like, it is pretty remarkable that they just stayed with it so fervently. Speaking also of CT's very lax security measures, I love how Mason's password is just Hendrix.
I love how he says it with like a little bit of embarrassment. And then Tony asks him how to spell it, and Mason is immediately annoyed, like, how the fuck else do you spell Hendrix?
I don't know. There's Hendrix gin.
Well, that's the thing. There are other ways to spell Hendrix. He's only irritated because he's like the fact that Tony doesn't immediately think of Jimi Hendrix is just pissing Mason off even more.
I like to think that Mason is just blasting Jimi Hendrix over the intercom.
Dude, no, you know when he got that, you know when he got that promotion out of Tacoma, he absolutely turned up, opened all his windows, took his clothes off, and played the national anthem, and just like flipped out. Had like an all day bender, you know, stumbled into the office 2 hours late the next morning.
I like to think that he just has a year round membership to the EMP. I guess it's called Mopop now, I think, but you know, like that he just hangs out there like next to like one of Jimi Hendrix's guitars just all day.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Like he routinely drives in from Tacoma to Seattle just to do that. Do nothing else. It's a great touch, but also like it's the most insanely I feel like not even Paula, I feel like just like some random low level person could hack into that in like 10 minutes.
Yeah, I do.
I mean, of course, you know, technology not quite as strong in 2002, but still it's, you know, it's strong.
Well, again, I think the idea is that in a world where 9/11 doesn't happen, people are like less concerned about these things. Even the agencies that are, you know, would seemingly be much more you know, like probably they have to have like every 6 months, you know, IT best practices training, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, you can just tell Mason is the kind of guy who hates computers. So he's not paying attention during those meetings. Like,
yeah,
no way. He'll make his and his password to everything is Hendrix.
That's true.
Like his absolutely his true. AOL email, his CTU login.
He probably has just like some random like internet, the proto internet subscriptions just on there.
Yeah, were there like dating websites at that time? Maybe he tried that out once.
So definitely Hendrix then.
Yeah, that was probably his username too. maybe he's on some forums. yeah. You know, Mason probably is on Expecting Rain. He's an Expecting Rain guy for sure.
is Kiefer Expecting Rain guy? It's a toss-up. That's a toss-up. I can see it going either way.
That is a toss-up. I think the thing with Kiefer is that he's famous enough to probably just like...
Yeah, absorb it by osmosis or something.
Yeah, or like, you know, if he wants to know
like
about...
He has an assistant like who puts on together through life, and that's how he learns.
Yeah. And he's probably like, you know, he probably gets his assistant to be like, you know, call up the Sony offices and be like, hey, you know, when's that next bootleg dropping? Like, how's that going? he's probably got some numbers that could get him in touch with Dylan Inc. if he really wanted to know, you know.
Yeah, that all sounds right. There's a good flow, I guess, just to a lot of these to the Jack and to the Jack and CTU stuff. Like the Palmer stuff is good. Like it's sort of, I think I kind of find it fascinating that they have Palmer as like a structuring absence throughout episode 3.
Yeah,
certain, like there's not a ton of it in episode 4 either, and like the focus really is on Michelle Forbes. I feel like she should probably be credited higher.
Yeah, she's doing great work in these episodes.
Yeah, she's not quite main cast, but she is like great in it. I especially love the scene where she's getting chewed out by Jack, and like she's just playing it really well.
Yeah,
Jack is playing it really well also, but like it's just like it's this great balance. But it also sort of brings up the question of like what is Lynn's background, like what is she like, is she part of any agency or is she just assistant? Like it's sort of like it's a
do we know what her job is?
Well, it just says special assistant to the president.
Okay, so it's one of those like bullshit sort of things.
And like it's the sort of like, I think Rayburn, who, by the way, this is like the last time he gets mentioned in the entire show.
His ass gets canned, and it's like really canned.
Yeah, it's really canned. Damn. Like he doesn't get mentioned even in like some of the other stuff that transpires. Brutal. Like he just is not present in the rest of the show. Like it's. I mean, I guess we get this to a certain degree with also with poor Paulo, like where they set up these people really vividly, yeah. only to just like totally dismiss them right away. but how he just effortlessly steps over Lynn for so much of it, and it like seems like he has enough influence where if she doesn't tell, if like Palmer didn't figure it out, that like Lynn would just like not dare to cross him. Like it's just like this weird he has just this weird influence that then just gets tossed away. Not in a bad way necessarily, but it's just like funny how strongly come on with him.
Yeah, it's sort of because their roles are a little bit ambiguous, it definitely feels like maybe he's like the more seasoned
deputy head of NSA, but considering how much influence Lynn seems to have with Palmer, like it's sort of yeah. like a weird position.
Yeah, I mean the thing about Palmer being absent is that I think what they're trying to do here is reintroduce his character in this new role, right? Which is a different kind of situation for him than running for president, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Where like on a campaign, not that you don't have a bunch of other people running around doing stuff, but you know, Palmer was I think like pretty active and involved in the planning and stuff. Whereas, yeah. you know, with the presidency, like he's spending so much time just in front of cameras and
yeah. Isn't he giving it like a sort of commendation to some person who's instrumental in like forest defense or something?
I don't know. I don't remember what it is that he's doing. It's not something that important. But I think what I like that's revealing about this is both that
the Natural Resources Defense Council. Yeah, the governor's efforts to protect Oregon's endangered species.
Oh yeah, because doesn't he make a joke in one of the early episodes about like
quota?
Yeah,
or like yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So that's like his whole Oregon trip then is probably like structured around that, right? But what I like about this is both that Palmer is shown as being perceptive enough to know like who's a snake in the grass and who's not,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
also that Lynn is shown as like knowing him better than this other guy. Like the things that she knows, the things that Palmer values ultimately, mm-hmm. which allow her to keep her job. You know,
yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting to have him like off screen for so much of it, but I thought that kind of worked out.
No, yeah, it's quite good. I always love Haysbert's performance, and like to have more of him, the better.
Yeah.
But like also like it's a good. I think it's a good choice, especially in this episode where it's like so much about Lynn.
Yeah,
I also love him rolling up and just like tearing apart Rayburn's report.
Yeah,
like he says, like I know you didn't have a lot of time to compile this or something like that. I have doubts or something like that. It's great. It's great stuff.
Yeah, and like you know, Rayburn's like, well, you know, my team has looked at 10 possible, and
I was hoping that they'd read off like, you know, like the most obvious target is like Beverly Hills or something. Like
yeah, that. I thought it was gonna be like all the places where rich people live, and that would have been
exactly.
Funny.
Yeah.
But like yeah, Palmer just cuts him off and is like, you're a joke.
I love like how just silly the idea of like him drafting this evacuation to take place over the course of a week, even when they know it's supposed to happen today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's just such a dumb move by him.
Yeah, this guy is just like so
He just doesn't get it. He's not on the same wavelength. Like,
yeah, he doesn't.
He's
at
so
all,
on his own wavelength.
Yeah,
that he doesn't want to adapt.
He doesn't at all get Palmer's more affective approach to mm-hmm, it, which mm-hmm, is you know,
right.
we gotta save people. He's sort of like, well, you know, if we save
right.
10 million, you know, if we save 5 million, you know, whatever.
Right.
He's very much a stats guy.
Yeah, yeah,
he's thinking big picture, which is you know his point about the CTU thing, which is like maybe we need to let this happen so that mm-hmm. we don't blow our cover, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, he's a little bit right,
yeah.
But he's such an asshole that no one cares.
Yeah, that's true.
Like there's probably a better. Like the thing is, with the time they have, there was probably a better way to organize some kind of less obvious, you know.
Yeah, like they, you know, they don't know exactly how many. The Eddie and Wald don't really know how many people work at CTU. They could evacuate some people, let them come in, plant the bombs, and like maybe let them blow up in the open or something like that. You know, like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, you know.
There's other ways. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It is sort of funny to me that the CTU attack is like a false flag, right? they got these right-wing terrorist guys to do false flag on CTU so they can, you know, distract from the nuclear bomb.
Right, right. It's a mildly irritating, but I get why they do it, but it's mildly irritating that even though they've made clear in this season that CT is located somewhere in West LA, when they do blow it up and you see the really big smoke cloud in the distance, like that's a surprisingly big one. Even if they parked, you know, a short ways away, it's still like pretty large, but you can clearly see the downtown in the background.
Yeah,
yeah, like you see the Wells Fargo,
Tower,
like that's clearly downtown. I don't know off the top of my head where that restaurant sign that's prominent in front of it is, but like it's clearly downtown, which, you know, like you'd consider that Central LA, slightly East LA, like it's somewhere in that range. Yeah. Like it's clearly not West LA.
Yeah, I will say though that cut was great from the interior to them looking at the explosion further.
There's
down
some
the
great
street.
Split screen.
I thought it was
work.
Just really nicely done. I don't even know that one wasn't even, I think, a split screen right away. I think it was just just like an edit.
Well, I mean, like especially just like this entire handling of the bombing stuff is like some of the stronger like filmmaking work that 24 has done, especially like just like the like when they have Jack and Tony and Michelle and Palmer just like all there on the split screen, like, and Kim is I think somewhere in the mix too, like when they're just like covering all these different perspectives at once. Like it's some really good work. I like how economical they are with just like shooting it so that they can have stuff falling from the ceiling without showing exactly where it's coming from.
Yes,
it's like, you know, it's coordinated chaos. Of course, it also made me think of like there has to be like a very strong 9/11 sort of influence also in like the way that they show the sort of aftermath, especially.
Oh yeah.
I can't remember where I read this, but I do think that like I heard once that a huge impetus in sort of having these more apocalyptic sort of blockbuster endings, you know, stuff like that, like especially in superhero movies like the Avengers, is that when like that 9/11 was really one of the first times that they had they had actually seen what a huge building falling down would look like.
Yeah.
So that they were able to like model the VFX after that, and so that's why there's been something of an uptake. I don't know if that's obviously that's not the only reason, but I think it's definitely like a key component. So like definitely to see it on a small scale, on a small TV scale, but still like to have something of that here, I think is
I mean, there's a whole you know, there's all kinds of studies on the visual effect of 9/11 on cinema, right? I mean, I very distinctly remember like Cloverfield being super controversial. Because it takes place in New York as well, which is sort of like doubly so, but you know, doing the, you know, the cloud rumbling down the street, right, which was like people freaked out, and you know, that was 7 years afterwards, but people absolutely flipped out at that. And of course, like, that I think was part of the marketing strategy as well. But yeah, that is interesting that just on like a certain kind of practical level, it's like even if you wanted to make it look a different way, just for stylistic reasons or whatever, because it's not like we didn't have filmed examples of destruction before, but that image becomes this iconic kind of thing. And it's like, well, yeah, if you're going to destroy a city, it's got to look like this, because this is what people respond to, right? Of course, now it's like that image has been produced and reproduced so many times, it's like a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy that it's like totally desensitized now. But
of course,
but I do think like what you're pointing out here, I definitely felt both the interior stuff, the kind of claustrophobia of it, you know, everything being kind of dusty and you know, the wreckage and kind of dimly lit, and then that cut to the street, which is obviously a different kind of destruction and explosion, but still like the silence of it and that shot straight down the street, you know, being again one of those things that like just kind of playing with that visual language already, like doing so in a less obvious way, but I thought it was a really interesting moment in the episode.
Yeah, definitely. It's the staging of it. Paula being up in Mason's office.
Yeah.
So that, like she gets like a Tony somehow gets, well, not honestly somehow, but like he, like, you know, plot armor and things like that. Paula just gets crushed under some debris or something like that, which, you know, there's a ton of it, but still like it's just a good like knowledge of where to put people in the right time, even if there's like just like it's funny to see like a ton of people like kind of slowly evacuating.
Yeah, yeah.
They're moving a little bit slowly for what I think, especially when Michelle and Tony, like, they know exactly what's about to go down. But it works. It all works, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think that again, though, I imagine that what I just feel like these four episodes could have been so effective. Well, I'd say the first three episodes could have been so effective as like a 2-hour season premiere, you know, ending that first week with the bombing of CTU would have been so sick.
That's true. Yeah.
But, yeah, it's still well worth it to get there. You know, it definitely makes the show.
Yeah. I feel like there's a good hour. Like if you had just cut out all the Kim and all the marriage stuff, I feel like that's probably runs in like just under 2 hours or something like that.
Yeah. 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 If you really cut this to the bone and the stuff that was working stayed, you'd have like one of the greatest season premieres of all time.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Like easily. Like it's a bummer that it takes them this long to get to it. It's really good once they do, but yeah, because you could have had like imagine that the Mason stuff happening in that first episode, it would have been pretty sick.
I like having the episode end on Mason though.
Yes,
like, I think it's a very good choice. Yes. Like it's sort of like a come down, but it's also like it's like this sort of nice deflation where you have this again the emphasis of the day and things like that. Like I feel like that's a strong touch.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the like show works on like this level of the big stuff happening, but the small stuff happening has to matter too, you know?
Right.
Like we have to care enough about this one person.
Yeah.
And that they're small stakes. Like, I think that's kind of a lesson that they sort of taught themselves in the first season too, which as bad as the, you know, the Kim stuff was in the first season, like the connection between the Kim and Terry stuff and the Jack stuff always felt very personal. Even as it got entangled in the broader stakes of the season, it's like moment to moment, that contrast when the show pulls it off works really, really well.
Yeah. But they just cannot do it yet for Kim.
They or just
for the marriage stuff.
Can't do. I just don't understand. I think that there's no really good reason to bring Kim back for this season. That's if true. It's not going to be dealing directly with her mom's death, and it's just not about that at all.
Right. Yeah. Like it's sort of like they're just too much extraneous stuff. Like I think the scene where they reveal that Megan had a skull fracture, and like the sort of very pointed look from the doctor, when I feel like Kim had to have explained that she was. Like she'd been a nanny working there for if it's been this systemic and Gary seems this incapable of hiding it, like how long had she been there? Like it doesn't compute for me.
Like, yeah. I felt like I missed something there. Like I wasn't paying enough attention because I'm like, not that a doctor wouldn't pick up on that stuff. Cause they obviously do. It happens a lot, but, the fact that like, you know, we know all Kim knows how to do is just like immediately blab everything. So like she would have come in there and been like, look, here's what's going on. I've got this situation, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know. And maybe that's like a scene that got cut or something. I have no idea because the stuff where it's like Kim's for some reason not saying what's going on or very weird.
Yeah. Like, just like all of it. I don't buy that any of it was conceived of like before the first episode, like the things leading up to like how long she had been there or something like that, or like how perceptive she was. Like it just doesn't, like it just feels like a very, like they're taking like 10 too many shortcuts or something.
Well, and that's again like just like the writers are constantly just turning the dial of like how dumb do we need to make Kim for a given moment to work. I really long for the mountain lion stuff at this point.
It's good. Yeah, I hope it comes soon so we can like
God save us.
Yeah. Yes.
Because at least like that, you know, that at least has like some kind of novelty to it, that this stuff just not.
Right.
It is not working.
Like it's like the, you know, bus conversation, like it's sort of, you know, it's like it's not the worst part of it, but it's still like pretty rote stuff.
Yeah.
I do like how Jack specifies that I think her aunt lives in San Jose or something like that, like which is a long drive.
Oh yeah, because when he's on
that's like a 6 hour drive.
Yeah, when he's on the phone with Kim, he's like, "Go to Aunt Carol's," or "Go to Carol's," and she's like, "Aunt Carol lives in such and such." I will say though that phone sequence was sort of fun.
Yeah, like seeing him sort of like trying to
having to like to keep balance. It together.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kim just flipping out and being like, "What is going on with you?"
Yeah,
I also love that there's a lot of great phone acting in these episodes. I love when Kiefer is like trying to call the president and he's like, "Please don't put me on hold." And then I think it's right after Lynn gets off the phone with him and she's like, "Jack Bauer called with specific instructions." And it makes me kind of wonder, like, how many of these characters, like, know who this guy is, right? Like, I like that she's just, like saying his name. Like, I don't know, like what context these other characters have for him. If it's just, like, the Palmer stuff or what. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I don't necessarily, like, it's sort of par for the course. Like, it's sort of, like, it is what it is. But I do feel like Jack, he could have done a better job at, like, I don't understand why he didn't leave the van himself and go tell security, like, you know, like he could tell them to like wait until they get out or something like that. Like him banking on the phone company guy to like deliver the message and things like that, like freeing him and all that sort of stuff. Like I feel like it just like it feels a little bit too circuitous or like considering like they're up there for a good. Like, 10-15 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Like, no one else is in the van with him.
Yeah, and I'm a little confused, like, you know, I think that, okay, so
I feel like it would have been a better idea for him to go and then come back instead of freeing the guy, which is clearly like a much more risky thing.
Yeah.
Even though it does get us that great sequence of him just slicing his head open.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a great touch. Oh, and also, so him just like getting mad at the guy for or telling the guy off or like being mad at him about his friend.
Yeah.
it's like you better get your ass in line or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a little bit muddled there is like Jack needs to remain undercover to get to Joe. But then like once he gets that, he just like wastes these guys.
it's great.
Which is a great sequence. A sick sequence. Dual wielding.
With a revolver, he throws it away halfway through.
Yeah, and then he's just staring down the car as it's barreling toward him.
Which a reminded me of Heat, and also there's a play on the Heat, like on like one of the Heat sort of more like synth driven or like, you know, like it's like a slightly percussive sort of moment.
Yeah,
and that reminded me it's a lot of the Heat theme, especially when they're robbing the bank.
Yeah, like it has
like that exact same sort of rhythm, which is. Like, which of course I like.
Mm-hmm.
It's good stuff. Like it's always fun to watch Jack dual wield. He should always have two guns on him when he's like in the field or something.
Yeah,
like
absolutely. Yeah, that was great. He shoots that weeby guy that was with them, who was like wiring up the bomb in the van earlier.
Yeah, yeah. And like who tied up the guy also?
Yeah, and who like has been suspicious of Jack the whole time is vindicated and then immediately gets smoked.
Yeah, like I like also that they have two weedy guys.
Yeah.
Both get smoked by Jack. Yeah. It's good stuff. It's yeah, like there's a like it's just fun. I like how he is banking on the fact that Wald won't get suspicious when he shows up, like by having his handkerchief on his head. Like, it's just he is pretty sure that he's gonna be able to get through with it.
I also love that this is the second season where some wacko just has a whole compound like right in the middle of Los Angeles that no one sees.
Yeah, Simi Valley, like it's sort of like, you know, slightly. I think it's north of, Ventura County. It's like, you know, slightly.
Look, to me, it's all LA. It makes no difference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true also. Wow, that's actually that's a long drive. It's 40 miles from downtown. So, like.
He gets there so quick.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Even on a Saturday, like, that's going to take at least.
Maybe if 9/11 doesn't happen, like, LA traffic gets solved somehow. Like, maybe the resources that, you know, nationally were put into anti-terrorism stuff after 9/11 like got diverted to, you know, decreasing traffic in major cities.
I like how this posits the 24 world as basically the utopia meme. where we have this scene where presidents get attacked every other year, and they like they get assassinated or get nearly assassinated, and like I like how this is the sort of halcyon version of our real world.
Exactly.
When 9/11 doesn't happen.
Yeah,
we have to keep this bit up now throughout the entire show. We have to keep bringing it up.
Yeah, I mean everything in the at this point, you know, everything in the show that's unexplainable can just be explained by the fact that 9/11 didn't happen.
So yeah, that's true. Like, we had some leeway with that before, like in day one, but in day two, we're firmly in a post 9/11 world, yeah, where 9/11 didn't happen.
Yeah, because also, you know, and obviously the timeline is ambiguous, and in the various, you know, theorizations and wikis, I think almost all of them disagree with me, but I think it's just absurd to decide that the year of a presidential election is just different in 24. Like, I don't think there's any reason to do that. So to me, it's like, no, the first season takes place in 2000. Like, obvious. Yeah. But you'll see all these timelines that say it takes place in 2002. And I'm like, there's no reason me to, like, why would that be the change that you make? So the first season takes place in 2000. This one's taking place now because, you know, Palmer was president. So he stopped 9/11 from happening because he didn't tell the government to do 9/11. So... so that's why it didn't happen.
I like to think that he consulted with Jack.
Yeah, he was like, look, they're talking about doing this thing called 9/11. What do you think about this? Check this out.
Now, this has to take place in an alternate version of Drill, where Drill, like, hey, come out of the bathroom, 9/11 is happening. that tweet, like, there has to be some, like, Drill variation on that. Like, maybe Jack is in there somewhere. I don't know. Like, maybe Jack is Drill.
Okay, so like Jack, we know that Jack isn't around to stop 9/11 because his wife just died, so he's a mess, right?
Yeah,
So like Palmer's got to be the one to step up, you know, so he stops it. But yeah, he's probably like calling Jack being like, hey, stop being depressed. 9/11 is happening. I need your help.
Maybe Jack is Drill.
Yeah, maybe that's like what they should do, you know, in the wider 24 media universe is do like a one shot comic book of Jack Bauer stopping 9/11 in the midst of just being like, you know, like he's wearing that flannel from the first, he's all like scraggly and like has like a beer in his hand. And
yeah, this is like what one, this is his last vow.
Yeah. 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 That's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, and then he comes back for another book, which turns into another 8 books.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's sort of.
Sorry, my cat's yelling at me.
No, it's okay. There's a great quote from Palmer to Lynn, where he's like, "I don't have time to appease your guilty conscience." another great Palmer line.
But I feel kind of bad though, because like I don't really think this is her fault.
Oh, it's not her fault. It's just like, it's sort of like he's like, do better, that sort of thing. Yeah,
Palmer's definitely a guy who gives orders like that, you know, better.
No question. Right. I like the previously on 24 reminded me that there's literally a moment where in episode 2 when Kim is driving out and Gary says like, get out of the car, I will kill you.
Yes, yeah. I also loved it previously on in episode 3 because it immediately starts with Mason. And us that like that
him walking
and then like the brief, like when his name flashes up and it briefly stops, it's like that freeze frame. So yeah, yeah.
It's a good freeze frame.
For I think for Mason's last episode they need to do like the 400 blows freeze frame.
I mean, there's like, Not to say how he goes out, but they, especially for how he goes out, they absolutely should have done it. Again, like with the wall panels, I'm just fascinated. Like, where are these like suction cups that they have? Like, is there just like one hanging on the hook
where they can?
It's just funny to me every time they open up the wall
pass. Yeah, yeah.
Especially like the it looks like a server room or something like that, but it's completely unguarded and there's no security. Again, no 9/11, but still, I feel like there's a
maybe it's not even like maybe 9/11 didn't happen for totally banal reasons. Like maybe they like missed their flight or something, got scared.
I hope this is like this takes place in like the universe where. I don't know, Seth MacFarlane was on the plane, but just like it was him being on the plane meant that.
No, Mark Wahlberg was on the plane. It didn't go down that way.
Well, that too. Like, but like, I like to think that the terrorists just saw him and they're starstruck by him being in Boogie Nights. So they forgot to do it. They're like getting his autograph or something. I like how you used the apartment TV in the conference room is one of the things that gets blown up. Like one of the places where the bomb is placed.
Yes.
Sorry, I don't know. It's like notes. They're fun notes. The great shot with the when Jack's van is pulling out and then Kim walks into the frame.
Yes.
I do like that.
Yeah, that's one of those great little wicked irony moments, you know, that they love to do. It's like, oh, she's right there, you know.
Right. Jack says that to the phone company guy, not today.
Yeah,
it's good stuff. And yeah, I guess like the two I think main primary remaining things. I guess first just like how sad like what they did to Paula.
Rough.
But it's also a great touch when Tony says like she deserves a chance to live to Mason when Mason like is going through like he knows he is going to die very soon.
Yeah.
I like this whole interplay thing they've been doing with Mason and Paula. I think that's actually like some really perceptive stuff. It's a shame that it lasts so short a time, but still like it's a good idea. Just the whole business with the dog and the shotgun.
Oh.
His jacket is just too puffy. The dog cannot get through it. Like Jack takes off his jacket and you think that he's going to check his arm for wounds or something like that, but he doesn't do anything like that.
He was just a little warm. I also love when he picks up the shotgun and does the classic, you know.
Oh, yeah, he does the
load the shotgun, rack. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And him, like, standing in front of the surveillance camera with the shotgun.
Oh, yeah. It's sick. Great. Although, yeah, I did notice it all of a sudden when Joe decides to blow his brains out, Jack becomes the slowest gun in the West and just like watches him do it, like doesn't try to do anything, just lets him like finish it off.
Yeah, like he had already gotten the information. I feel like he was probably
he's not inclined. Yeah,
he's like, you know, like he spent like months of his life with this guy. He probably thought very little of him.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably content with him just like going through with it. Before we get also there's just like great Michelle Tony moments.
Yeah, that's
that scene with the back, like,
yep.
when she's reaching out to touch his back, like the like out of before sunset or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that stuff is starting to work out nicely, and also like Tony kind of having his moment, you know, in charge to
he's just completely overwhelmed.
Yeah, like his struggle with that, because he can't. Like, he's barking orders and telling people what to do, but he just doesn't have, like, the Mason touch, you know? Because he's really, too nice of a guy at this point still.
Mm-hmm.
Did we briefly want to mention the very last moment of episode 4?
Let's talk a little bit more about Mason.
Okay.
I love him showing up. He says he doesn't, or, like, to the police officers, he says, like, he wants to be there even less than they do. like, how he's like, lazily holding the pistol, but then he eventually takes over like
takes point
he takes point because like the guys are just moving too slow for us, like, you know, like that. Weirdly like the specific radioactive chamber, and also Mason using the guy like as an inadvertent body shield, like it reminded me of Mission Impossible 2, all things.
Oh,
like the green glow on his face.
I love how Mission Impossible movie.
I love the yellow on his face.
Yeah.
Like his face is like slightly yellow from gas.
Yeah.
And also there's a great cut from him being hosed down in decontamination and how clearly agreed Xander Berkeley is, like yeah. how he's just like getting water in his face
yeah.
and like he's getting scrubbed down and he's just like totally mad about it.
Yes.
And it cuts from that to Paula washing her hands in the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In the, I love those playful famed, little cuts.
Yeah,
that
yeah the famed CTU women's restroom.
I love it. He has a line with Tony when he comes back to CTU and he's like, I don't have to answer to you, so drop yeah. the attitude. Like talking to him like he's a little kid.
Yeah, yeah. He's just so yeah, it's just great stuff with Mason. I really hope they maintain this level because this is like this is the best stuff I think 24 has done for me. Like best arc that 24 has done for me so far.
Yeah, it's really just humming right along.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yes, Nita's back. I like how they like this is I like how quickly they bring Nita back. Like it's sort of another it's not quite a gimmick, but it is just like it's a I don't know exactly how to describe it, but like it's sort of like this device, this like ace card that they can pull in to.
I think it just is part of, and again, like if I could offer some notes for revision on this 20-year-old season of television, it would be that like imagine that, you know, week one your 2-hour premiere ends with CTU blowing up and week two yeah. ends with this Nina reveal. Like what a 1-2 punch that would have been.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been so sick. I think that unlike the Kim stuff, the Jack stuff is actually interested in dealing with the fallout from last season.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it's not just about that. Like that's the thing, too, is that, you know, the benefit that Jack as a character has is that he's got to be mixed up in all the action and, mm-hmm. and like, the driving force. But also, like, yeah, I can't wait to watch those episodes, you know? Like, it's going to be so sick.
Yeah. Did you have any more notes?
No, I think that's it.
Yeah.
Great couple of episodes. I was feeling a little deflated after mm-hmm. the first two, but yeah. the magic is back, baby.
Yeah, it's definitely like a certain kind of 24 magic. Like for me, like I don't love it, but like it's just very enjoyable. And just like, you know, slight reductions in the Kim and wedding stuff go a long way.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Maybe not quite as much as I'd hope, but still, like it's still like very much this nice. It's got a nice energy to it. There was a one trivia thing that I thought I remembered. Oh yeah, this is the classic Wiki24 entry. The bomb at CTU exploded about 40 seconds later than it should, according to the real time concept. It is true that they show like the clock on the very prominent on the bomb, so like it helps them calculate that, but still like it's a very funny thing to
yeah. I do like that there's someone like watching the show with a stopwatch or something double checking.
Yeah.
You know, like TV time is elastic, and even though the show is in real time, like we don't want 40 minutes of Jack just driving to Simi Valley, you know. He needs to be there in the next scene. That's just sometimes you gotta move the laws of physics around.
Yeah, with a shot out window.
Yes, yeah. Like, I don't know. That seems like maybe the kind of thing you get pulled over for in LA, but maybe not.
Yeah,
maybe you didn't get on the highway. I feel like if you're not on the highway, maybe not as big a deal.
Yeah, I mean, like, there has to be a certain threshold for you to get pulled over on LA highways.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's a... just thinking about the sort of the like wooden shed that Wald has in his backyard that like has this metal safe room.
Yeah.
it's a funny idea. I hope we need to keep doing this like episode by episode Jack's version revision of this season of 24.
Yeah, you know,
like, I wonder how many episodes we'll have by the end of it.
If I was like a little bit more brain damaged, I would be the kind of person who would just like re-edit the show. Like,
don't tempt me.
You know, me. Well, I'm saying this because I know you have the technical capability, though yeah, yeah. certainly not the time. You know, like, like you know, like how they cut up the Jackson Hobbit movie and made it like a like one solid, you know, 3-4 hour movie. It's like, yeah, what if you just like made, you know, took all the good stuff and then all the connective tissue that was absolutely necessary and just, you know, then that was the show. I wonder how long it would be.
Man, I'm thinking of like a version where Kim's scenes are just the scenes where Jack or CTU are also involved with it. Like just like Kim just like randomly showing up with this little girl, like, and like after a little while, then like Kim just randomly shows up at CTU. Well,
I love that because like, okay, so I'm pretty sure it would be the scene where Jack visits her at work, and then the next scene she's in would be the phone call.
she takes the phone call from him later, where she, like she where he calls her to leave.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. So like, there's that, and then the next scene is her just like somewhere in like South LA or something.
Got this little girl. The police are after her.
Yeah, but they don't specify why. It's great. Great.
That would be so good. That would be so good.
Yeah.
And like at this point, I mean, obviously at some point, I'm assuming that this is not going to be the case. But at this point, I don't see any reason why any of these wedding scenes would be in it at all.
Yeah. I mean, like eventually, I think there will be at least some. Yeah. There will be some like important points, including directions you might not expect. But like, it's sort of. I've no clue how it gets to that place where you wouldn't expect that.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, like it's really, like it's remarkable how completely untethered it is.
It's so,
especially like when they have all this pressing stuff with Walden and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Until next time.